Okay, so with that, let's move on and talk about the topic which we've been sort of talking about for the last hour, which is storytelling in video games. Now, this is sort of sparked by the post I did earlier this week on serialized storytelling. Now, do both of you know what that term means?
Yeah.
Ken?
No.
Serialized storytelling basically is a sort of a play off of the old serials that they did with radio and TV in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. What it was basically, well, back then, they basically ended every episode with a cliffhanger, you know, the old Batman type. You know, will Batman get out? Tune in next week. It was pretty much a way of connecting episodes together so that you couldn't really miss an episode because they would, of course, say something or do something important. Now, serialized storytelling is a lot harder to write for because you're not just writing a one-off episode, you know, the gang goes to the beach or something like that. You're basically writing a 10 or even 20 episode arc, or even with stuff like Game of Thrones, it's all based on the multiple books. Now, the big example recently would arguably be Breaking Bad, which, of course, had its big finale, I think, 2 weeks ago. And Breaking Bad is a classic example of a serialized story. It's a, I think, 56 episodes, each one basically continuing the story. There is no filler. There is not one episode that nothing really happened. But with the concept of serialized storytelling, that doesn't mean that, at least in my opinion, that it's the, you know, golden standard of what stories should be. Because we've seen a lot of great shows that are not about serialized. The one that I mentioned was The Twilight Zone, which hopefully you both know what The Twilight Zone is.
Oh, I don't know what that. Of course I know what that is.
But The Twilight Zone was completely not serialized. Every week was a brand new episode, brand new character, setting, plot. There was no guidelines to it. So you could miss 2-3 episodes of it and you don't need to worry about it. But you can't say the same thing for a show like Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones. With those types of shows, you miss, you know, 2-3 episodes. Who knows what happened in that span of time? Now, bringing this back to video game storytelling, let's start with AAA developers. The problem with a lot of AAA games is that, as we talked about when I talked with Jason and John Schaefer, is that most AAA games are aimed at being the blockbusters. These games that are meant to be, you know, you're at the height of the civilization, you're going to save the world, kill the bad guy, win everything. And while they're great for the short term, they're just very poor examples of storytelling because they're one and done. Even with a game like Bioshock or Bioshock Infinite, they have these settings that are such, you're basically at the eve or the twilight of everything going down that once you've seen that, it's very hard to write more stories. But as I said in the post and what we talked about earlier, they're going a different route, which I think is really smart, is they're exploring these different themes or these different universes within Bioshock. So I guess the first question for both of you is, in terms of AAA developers, are there any major stories or games with good storytelling that you can think of?
The one I recently played that I loved was Tomb Raider, the reboot.
Ooh, yeah.
Which is a strong story. I think it's really cleverly told. I love how ambiguous they are about the supernatural elements in it and how it's all rooted in the experiences and perceptions of the people who've kind of crashed on the island. And it's got lots of really strong character work. And kind of the deeper you dig into kind of finding the written records and stuff, the more you find out about the characters' relationships and the history of the island and stuff, which is really satisfying from a kind of exploratory standpoint.
I think
it's really good.
The reason I actually wanted to get the game was because of that, like the mystery behind the island. The more videos I watched, the less plays and stuff, I wanted to know why she's being attacked and why these people are so crazy. And I mean, they got shipwrecked on the island. You think there'd be civilization still, but it looks like these people are pretty ruthless and cruel. I want to know why. So I also like the concept of she's an archaeologist, right? So she actually finds items and looks at them and actually gives some sort of information about it. That's great.
Yes. Yeah.
Like example, like I think the first one she finds is like a ceremonial mask and it's the face of a scorned woman. And she flips it around and sees there's like white paint or something on the nose, saying that was a woman of nobility.
Yeah.
Right. That was wearing it before. So yeah, I love that because it kind of gives you some education, right? And it is based on real world facts.
Yes, and that helps. How can I put this? That helps establish the island in Tomb Raider is one of the main characters. Apart from Lara, is the next main character, and all those little bits of archaeology you dig up help establish the history of the island and kind of the like the stratas of occupation that it's gone through and all these different people that it's gobbled up and spat out in horrible shapes. And it really fleshes out the setting and gives it a kind of consistency and roots it in real history, which makes it, I don't know, add something. I don't know what it adds. It's just a frisson or word. I don't know. And authenticity is not right, but it attaches it into the wider world anyway, which makes it more satisfying.
I think what you just said about it being its own character, I think that's a really good point. When you have, like, when we talk about Bioshock Infinite a few months ago, the setting of Columbia is just such a fantastic place, excuse me, because of the fact that it's rooted not so much in reality, but it's rooted in its own fiction. Mm. You can see how the world works. You can see why things are floating, understand why the people are this way. It's not like you're just dropped into Columbia and that's it. You basically understand the whole mythology behind it. And as you said with Tomb Raider, that island, there is a rich history to it that establishes itself as more than just a backdrop for Laura running around killing guys.
Right, and by the way, in Bioshock also, I think that what they really missed out on, like the what people really enjoyed about that game was the exploration of it. In the beginning, you get a good sense of the world, right? And in the demo videos, like before the game came out, there was a point where you could actually, there was like, I guess, a postman that was going to be killed for being part of another faction. But you could have either saved the guy or just avoid it and just keep walking by. And there was a lot of scenario that was non-violent, and I think that should have been the way they went. But it must have been too complicated, and that's why they went the other round.
Or they wanted more gunplay to sort of make the game appeal more to a wider audience as well, which I know Ken Levine talked about, and I think it was a post or pre-interview of the game, which was one of the reasons why they changed the title.
And the cover.
The cover screen, exactly.
To just a guy. Well, Last of Us is the opposite, where they put Ellie right in the cover.
I think that's one really productive way to do a story in game is to make the story be the story of a place, of an environment. Because what games are really good at, and what all the hardware has been engineered to do, is explore 3D spaces. The kind of that's what the original kind of 3D graphics cards were for, and what the physics cards are for, and it's what game development has focused on, is creating kind of authentic environments to occupy. And it's the technology hasn't focused on, for example, duplicating kind of consistent human motivation or making characters in the game that respond to you realistically. Obviously, there's motion capture and stuff, but that's the veneer. That's not, you know, what's going on inside. It's very hard to do a truly dynamic situation in games. Unless you take the Walking Dead route, which basically presents you with a series of conundrums, and it's if you strip all the fiction and stuff off it, it's a flowchart, which is the only way to do that. If you tried to do that in a sort of open world game that played like Bioshock Infinite, I don't even know how you'd start doing it. But that's, I think, one of the difficulties that games face is that stuff. If you're trying to do the kind of films that people agree are like the best films, like, you know, Casablanca and Godfather Part 2 and everything, are all about people doing things to one another, generally horrible things, and kind of bouncing off each other. And everyone in this situation can't get out of the situation but wants something different. And the story and the drama is what comes about when they crash. And computer games are not set up to do that.
Of course, yeah. And that goes back to the whole idea of the blockbuster type design. When you're supposed to be the big hero, you can't be seen as weak, or you can't have like the game end with the main character failing.
Well,
I mean, like failing as in like you do the wrong thing and calamity happens, kind of thing.
I guess so. You can die at the end, can't you? But it has to be to kind of redeem everything.
The self-sacrifice stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
I think that's also partly because gameplay is to a significant degree about challenge and overcoming an obstacle, and it's hard to mesh that with a story that isn't about the same subject, which is why there's so many save the world game stories in games, because it's the biggest obstacle you can be faced with, and it's something that you can't ignore. You can't like say, I don't think I'll bother, it doesn't really affect me if the world explodes. It's a situation that you have to kind of deal with, even though now we've seen it so much it's kind of lost all its power. But that's, I think, we might say I think you often see in kind of games journalists' pieces, you know, wanting to see games that aren't about saving the world or saving an empire or being the hero of a particular kind of much grander situation. But that's just the stories that fit best with kind of challenge-based game mechanics.
That makes sense.
And as you just said regarding the gameplay sort of not meshing with the narrative, that brings one of the complaints a lot of people have about when cutscenes or QuickTime events basically play the game in a different light than what the player was used to. Such as when you, like, let's say you're completely stealth, you're killing everyone, you're doing fine, then enter a cutscene and now you're in the middle of a room and you've been detected by 20 guards and now you're forced into a firefight.
Good God.
When the narrative clashes with what the gameplay expects, it usually leads to a weaker narrative overall. Like with BioShock Infinite, I guess this would, is it all right to, I guess this would be sort of
spoil the ending. Don't spoil the ending.
I'll just say that a lot of people didn't like the fact that there was no choice. Let's just leave it.
No one's playing that game anymore. We got a four.
Yeah. No, I think what to me, like the disconnect thing, like a lot of Japanese games, they have the main character being like so cool, right? Like Devil May Cry kind of thing. And like they do insane things in cutscenes, but when you get back into the gameplay, you can't do any of those things.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay. Like in the cutscene, you took out like huge tanks just by yourself, and now you can barely dent a wall.
And now that tank is, you know, the super hard boss that you have to spend 30 minutes whittling down health.
Yeah, I think that really annoys me when it's that kind of disconnect.
Now, going back to Tomb Raider and just AAA development for a second, another issue as we talk about in terms of narrative is the concept of the chosen one or the alpha hero. You know, you have to be the center of the story and the world is sort of contorted to fit around you. And this is a problem that we see with a lot of games like God of War, even like something like Uncharted, where this whole world pretty much just exists for the player to run around to go from cutscene to cutscene. And this is one of the issues I have with the whole blockbuster mentality, is that once you take that player out, the world is just nothing. Like, for example, could you imagine playing a God of War game without Kratos, just like a random soldier in that universe?
Dead pretty fast.
Yeah. Now, with Tomb Raider, it sort of has that by the fact that you're playing as, you know, badass Lara Croft. But as you said, though, its setting is so established that it sort of does help that. Like, I could see them do, like, a prequel on that island, you know, with another civilization.
It would be grim, but yeah, you could. And I think it kind of helped that Lara wasn't a... At the start of the game, she's not a powerhouse, is she? She's very, very vulnerable, and it's a struggle for her,
She keeps saying, I can do this in the beginning.
She's trying to reassure herself. Yeah.
That's a great story bit that they keep putting into all different sections, you know? I love that.
Yeah.
And then she gets a maniac at the end.
Yeah.
I can do this!
There's a game that did do that, though, that took the alpha hero and then did a game where you were just an average Joe. Halo, ODST.
Oh, yeah.
Where you're not Master Chief anymore. You're just like one of the grunts. And it was still basically the same gameplay and stuff. I don't think you had shields or you had much more of your shields or rubbish or something. But they'd managed to kind of build the universe to the extent that it could support doing that in it. And I don't think they treated ODST as like a full on, it didn't have the fanfare as like Halo 3 type release. Yeah. It was done more as a sort of side project.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. As we talk about with AAA developers, when you're kind of stuck making these multi-million dollar projects, you have to put your most explosive best foot forward. So, like, going back to God of War, that's why Kratos always is the main character, because he's the macho, super male, fantasy type character that sells games. You wouldn't play God of War if you were, you know, Spartan Grunt 27.
No, by the way, talking about the whole, like, you have to be the center of attention and everything, and, like, the classic hero story, I think Longest Journey does a good job of turning it on its head, if you know what I'm talking about, Chris, eh?
I can't remember.
I can't tell you.
I'm going to have to go read a wiki now.
I'll tell you. But let's just say they build it all up. They build it up to something that you'd expect, and they pull the rug underneath you, and it's amazing. And that's one of the first games that I've played that have done that. So, and I think it reflects pretty well, because I remember during the Dreamfall campaign, the writer talking about how a lot of the events that happened in both stories in that and Dreamfall reflected his feelings on his life at the current moment. Mm. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'll tell you after the cast. Not to spoil anything.
I think the other kind of motivation behind the kind of blockbuster, everything's exploding, end of the world stuff is these aren't honest, kind of, to goodness, free to play games we're talking about. These are big, these are big kind of retail games that you have to slap down $50 for. So you've got to have stuff that looks in, in trailers and on TV and stuff. You know, you've got to have big dramatic stuff to help sell the game, to get people excited to fork out a huge amount of money to pay for them. I think that's, there's a reason you see a lot of this stuff in AAA games, and that's kind of partly it, that the stakes have to be high to help motivate people to purchase.
I think another deal is that when you look at AAA games, even though they have, some of them have sequels, the stories are never really connected in the sense that game one doesn't end with a cliffhanger or doesn't really continue into game two. And the reason is that, as we said, there's so much risk involved that what publisher in their right mind would greenlight a game, a 10-game story, and what happens if the game stops selling after game two and they just greenlit 8 more games? I mean, it's just a fool's gambit to bet 10 games on a story that may or may not sell. So they have to go with that blockbuster route, making each game its own super fantastic game, and that, in the process, limits what they can do in terms of storytelling.
That's why they milk IP, that's why they milk IPs to the ground, you know what I'm saying? So
I'll play devil's advocate there, because I think there is someone who does it. I think BioWare did it. I think BioWare got a lot of crap there, I think, but Mass Effect was intended as a big trilogy from the get-go.
Right.
And yeah, it's a trilogy, not 10 games. But one game of Mass Effect is, what, like at least 10 hours of play.
Yes.
It's not short, a short game. Dragon Age is taking a different approach in that it's not the same character, not the same lead character in each game, but the same characters appear in, reappear in different games. And it's the same setting, and kind of the story of the setting progresses through it as well. And both of those are interesting because they do take save states from earlier games, so they pay direct attention to what the player's done to populate the next game.
Yep, with Mass Effect, after I wrote my post on serialized storytelling, I thought about it. Mass Effect would be probably one of the few examples of AAA games having a serialized story, because as you said, it does continue from 1 to 2 to 3, and I think that's sort of why we saw so much of an outcry over Mass Effect 3, because when you have that serialized story, you know, people become very invested in their characters in the setting.
No, I don't, to me, honestly, I think the reason why I was even allowed to go that far is because they weren't owned by EA yet. Dragon Age, Origins, and Mass Effect was being, you know, produced and created before the purchase ever happened. So that game, you know, definitely has all of the telling marks of BioWare. And I think the second Mass Effect was actually a good mix between EA's strategy of, like, actioning it up along with BioWare's storytelling. I think Dragon Age 2 was, like, Dragon Age 2 and Dragon Age and Mass Effect 3 are, like, the a lot of mishandling by EA, in my opinion.
I think I haven't finished Dragon Age 2 yet, so I'm playing it at the moment. But I think, in terms of storytelling, it's kind of groundbreaking, because I'm not a huge fan of the combat. I think partly because I feel like I've played a lot of that type of combat now. I played a lot of Neverwinter Nights and stuff, and it's very much a kind of continuation of that. But the idea of it setting it in a single city rather than you kind of going off and exploring everywhere and then kind of revisiting that city over a period of multiple years and seeing how it's changed over a course of years isn't something I can think that was done anywhere else in games. And that concept kind of interested me quite a lot more than a sort of save the world plot or anything. And you're not saving the world in it either, relevant.
Nope.
You're kind of guiding the fortunes of one city. I think BioWare also are the ones that do come closest to having a kind of situation comprising a number of characters. And it's generally not the sort of core plot that represents that, but your party is such a point of focus for BioWare games, and they put so much effort into making every character their own distinct voice and to have their own interests to the point where it is incompatible with other party members, and you're often forced to a point where you have to choose between one or the other. And that's not the sort of drama or gameplay you get in a lot of other games. I can't think of any, except ones that are, like, you know, related to BioWare, like the Black Isle games and stuff.
Yeah, I really do like the concepts of, I mean, even Dragon Age 2, whatever I would say bad about it, I still really love the dialogue written for it. I think the characters are still very strong, I just think that they suffered from, you know, what any problem with big publishers is they have, you know, certain quarters they need to release games in. And, you know, Dragon Age Origins, which has a great, like, you know, history, Dragon Age 2 was really, really rushed. And it shows, because, like, go to a dungeon, there's, like, tons of dungeons look exactly the same. That like, example, you know that molten lava dwarven temple underground thing? Okay, that's used for a cave, that's used for underneath a marketplace, that's used for an actual temple, you know what I'm saying? They just cut off different areas of it, so it felt like it was really cheapened for that reason. I really do love the concept of a city over time, but I also think it was to save on art assets, too. Like, that was a good sell to EA to that, you know?
Well, if you think about it, with Silent Hill 2, the whole fog mechanic, which we all love as a great aesthetic, the story is that it was originally designed as a way to cut down memory because they couldn't render the whole city at the time. But sometimes you do get, like, those hidden blessings.
This one, I don't know about this one. Was might be a great idea, and it definitely could be, like, artistic expression and good storytelling or good writing. But, again, I think it was to, because they had, like, maybe a quarter of the development time as Dragon Age Origins, but 3 years. This one had less than a year. So they had to just say, This storytelling method will work, and we'll push it through this direction. That's my theory.
I'm really pleased that Dragon Age 3 has had this. They pushed back the release date, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Yeah, that's good.
It's very good. I really loved Origins, and I really loved Awakening, which was the expansion.
Yeah,
both were very good in terms of like shedding more light on this interesting world. Like I think one of the most interesting things to me. And this is gonna go pretty far in, I don't know if the viewers will get it, but there's this, you know what the Fade is? The Fade, right?
Yeah.
Is where you go.
There's so the demon world,
Well, it's actually both, like, well, there's both benevolent and good spirits in it. But the good ones just, like, don't ever interact with you. they don't care. Except for one, and that's an Awakening. The Spirit of Justice becomes a party member of yours.
Yeah.
But, there's something called the Black City. And if you look in the Fade, no matter where you are in the Fade, you see the Black City, equidistant to where you are. And there's so much mystery behind it. And again, there's
the history of the setting.
Right. They say the Divinity.
Yeah.
They say that's where the Darkspawn came from, right? The plague came from. They also say that the Divinity Empire destroyed itself by entering that place. It was a golden city before it was a black city.
It's like heaven. The Divinity Empire made a path to heaven and entered heaven. And because of their hubris, everything was kind of passed down.
Yeah, and it's so interesting, like, that concept and, like, their mythology and their whole world creation. I find that amazing. I really love it. And then
it's so brilliant that it's there in the sky anytime you're in the Fade. Just in any other game, it'd just be mentioned kind of in books and stuff, wouldn't it? But it's a physical place you can see in the game.
Yeah, and it creates such, like, mystery because they don't tell you any sort of details. Everything, it's all hearsay. No one really knows. In fact, there's actually one surviving Tevinter, and I guess an expansion for Dragon Age 2 that mentions it already being dark, so you're like, whoa, what does that mean? I'm just saying,
They're really good at that, about kind of creating historical ambiguity and not pinning down exactly what happened or who saw what or did what. There's kind of multiple accounts of the same thing.
Yeah, which is, again, that's why I love BioWare storytelling in both Dragon Age and Mass Effect. I think they do a really good job of both characters and world creation.
And as you just said about the history, I know with Mass Effect and Dragon Age, they had, like, that codex, or, like, the encyclopedia of all the events, people, species. And that's a great way of developing this world, making it more than just about the main character. Now, here's a question for both of you. We talked about Dark Souls earlier in the cast, and how what they did is that the story is told in two ways. One is by the setting itself, and how each place has its own theme, its own little history to it, like Anolondo and Lost Islet. These are two very different places, and they have very different stories about how they came to be. But then there's also, as Chris mentioned, a lot of the story is very passive. It's in the item descriptions. Like, the painting has, in order to get into it, you have to get a doll, I think, from another area, which I'm not going to spoil. But when you look at that doll in the inventory, it has this whole story about this little girl and what happened to her. And the doll is sort of the representation of it. So for both of you, is that kind of storytelling something that you like, having it sort of be this very passive experience?
Yes, I love Dark Souls' story. Part of what I love about it is the ambiguity, that you're not getting things aren't being pinned down and explained fully. And that preserves this fantastic air of mystery and uncertainty to the setting, even when you've played lots of the game, even when you've passed through an area and explored it thoroughly, there's still this kind of sense of uncertainty about it. At the same time, you have to work quite hard to find quite a lot of the story. I just feel that there's a room for a little bit more overt storytelling in there. Not a lot. I wouldn't want them to go too far. I wouldn't want lots of cutscenes or anything. But I think they could probably make their dialogue work, do a bit more of the work, because it's really interesting when you hear stuff about the world from characters in the world. They're really good at that, because their characters are all so insane and have such strong kind of viewpoints and opinions about the world. I'd like to see a little bit of the emphasis shifted to that.
Yeah, like, I would like to know what the hell's with Smog and Ornstein, those two bastards.
To me, I just don't like. I do like that to a degree, but I just don't. I don't like it like Final Fantasy XIV, where everything is a wall of text. A wall of text is there to kill you. just watch like Final Fantasy XIV 1.0 and watch a cutscene and you just want to pull your eyes out of your sockets and it's horrible. Just walls and walls and walls of unnecessary text. Because the text needs to say something. It can't be just a description, you know? Like the concept of ambiguity and the hints and lore, I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
But when it's there just describing a rusty key, I'm like,
Yeah. And I think that's one thing that works in Dark Souls' favor is the item descriptions are all very brief. It's tiny little snippets, isn't it? It's never
having
to read a whole page of text or anything. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not Final Fantasy XIV where like this key had was a key to someone's father who was in a war that happened 300 years ago with some guy with some arbitrary name, part of a kingdom where like it's a bunch of random stuff that you don't care. You don't read and they're never mentioned ever again. You're like, okay.
One of my favorite tabletop role-playing game designers talked about this in an interview recently, because you get a lot of this in tabletop role-playing games as well. And he said he described it as games that start with someone saying, 10,000 years ago, all this stuff happened, and it's really important, but nobody cares. It's completely irrelevant by the time you're playing the game, but you're expected to give a crap.
That's a great quote, by the way. I'm going to put that. I should put that on the website. 10,000 years ago, something happened. No one cares.
I think the one of the problems you get into with game storytelling is when the game designers or writers really want to be making film or writing a book, but they have to leave space for you to press buttons, it ends up with you kind of feeling alienated and having to read through swathes of stuff you don't really care about. And those stories tend not to be kind of character driven stories. They tend to be about whatever. The number of role playing games with just awful, schlocky, pseudo medieval fantasy worlds that are exactly the same as all of the others. And, you know, we're expected to care that there's an orc invasion or whatever. We don't care. We've seen it a million times before.
And don't forget the protagonist who has amnesia.
The worst.
Oh, God. Yeah. Except when it's the best, like in Planescape Torment. I think one of the, there's this great interview with Chris Avalon on YouTube where he talks about Planescape Torment and Knights of the Old Republic 2 and how the kind of stories and themes for both games had their origins in a kind of bubbling pit of hate for how games told stories, and it's and they're all kind of reactions to that, which is why there's no halflings in or hobbits in Planescape Torment or elves, because he hates them and he's sick of them and he doesn't want to see them anymore, and why death in Planescape Torment is often a way to kind of overcome a problem or a resource that you can use to address the situation. You can never die permanently. It's why there is only one, maybe two magic swords in the whole game. He kind of stripped everything he hated out of it, or put a different spin on everything.
Nice.
To make it different.
Well, I think he was successful then, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Now, speaking about what you just said about a lot of writers, game designers who are trying to tell movies instead of video games, that's probably the perfect segue to the next topic, and the other major AAA developer, David Cage, who, as we talked about before, he's very opinionated guy about what video game storytelling should become, where video games should evolve as a medium, but his games have left a lot of people conflicted about their quality and their general storytelling. I know with his latest game, Beyond Two Souls, the reviews are being split. I've seen 8s and 9s, and I've seen 3s and 4s, and both are pretty much one praises the storytelling, the other just, you know, says it's horrible storytelling. Now, with, like, David Cage and his type of games, like Fahrenheit, Heavy Rain, they have very basic gameplay. A lot of it is, you know, gesture or motion-based, and most of it is about telling the story. So, for both of you, what do you think of that type of game design, or that type of storytelling?
I haven't played Heavy Rain, although I've watched quite a lot of kind of playthroughs of it. And I haven't played Beyond Two Souls. I have played Fahrenheit.
Indie Gap Prophecy.
And I've played some of, have you played Omicron, A Nomad Soul?
Yes.
I've played a bit of that. Omicron and Nomad Soul is one of the weirdest games in the world. The tutorial itself weirded me out because the tutorial is David Cage himself explaining how to play the game.
He did that in Fahrenheit 2, I think, or he did it in the demo.
Oh god, he did, didn't he? Yes, you're right.
I don't remember this.
It's creepy. It is creepy. It's like him sitting kind of there, taking the controller off and saying, no, that's not how you do it. Andy. And sort of telling you how kind of important all this stuff is and something. It's really weird and slightly icky. It's
like, do that for your next game, by the way. Hello, this is how you play this game.
But I think Fahrenheit seems less... He's gone down this quite kind of movie-driven path. Recently, more from Omicron and Fahrenheit. Fahrenheit had quite a lot of that in it, but it still had lots of stuff where your choices could affect the course of the narrative in quite drastic ways.
Really drastic ways.
Yeah. And even when it wasn't affecting you drastically, you couldn't tell because there were times when it did. And it was really good at the sleight of hand surrounding that. Really satisfying. But that too had all this had lots of stuff where you kind of sections where you didn't really feel you had to be there, and I think while kind of cinema is your model of what good storytelling is, you're always going to struggle in the game space because you don't write for the main character who is the player, so you've got to somehow write a story where you don't know what the main character is going to do. Or you have to not allow the main character any genuine freedom, which is not why a lot of people play games. I don't want to say everyone, but some people don't care at all. You know, plenty of people played Heavy Rain and totally loved it. Heavy Rain didn't have any kind of supernatural stuff in, and it was a lot of the kind of crises were sort of real world crises, although potentially sort of melodramatic and exaggerated and stuff. And that's the sort of experiment we should see lots more of in games, but the reviews for Beyond, the reviewers all sound very cross that they're kind of being forced to just press A or B every now and again during a movie.
I think generally people dislike QTEs of any kind, and in every review there's always a complaint of abuse of it. I mean, Shenmue started that trend. I mean, well, they weren't the first, but they made it super popular. But I think now it's becoming more of a chore. It doesn't feel like the buttons and the combinations are actually affecting anything. They just feel like it's just something you have to do,
it's
like
an arbitrary action.
So that's not very engaging at all.
And if the outcome of it is you die and you have to do it again, that's a really bad QTE. You have to ask what it's even doing there. I understand the basic concept behind QTE because it's to keep the player. You're doing something staged and elaborate that you couldn't do you couldn't rely on happening in your standard game engine. So you want to do something a bit out of the ordinary, but you don't want people to sort of, I don't know about you guys, but when a cutscene comes on for me, I might put the controller down or I'll lean back, you know, how I'm interacting with the game changes. And they want to keep the player, the point of a QTE is to keep the player engaged while they're doing it. But while there are ways to make that work and then there are ways to make it not work. And, I think it's particularly bad for games reviewers because they play so many games, they have to play many, many QTEs. And so they're just sick of the sight of them. There was so Tomb Raider had some QTEs in, and it had a couple of really bad ones. I think there's one where you're in a kind of, there's a plane falling and you're inside it, and it's very exciting. But if you get it wrong, you just die.
In a horrible way, by the way.
In a horrible way.
Always horrible.
There were no nice deaths.
Yeah, I know. I was surprised too by some of those QTEs.
So brutal.
So hard. I think it was actually too far from you.
I think I even said to myself, like, ugh, that just happened to her?
I think the best QTE kind of moment that wasn't a QTE was when she got her leg caught in bear trap. In the scenario, she like walks, she gets caught in bear trap, and then she has to use her bow and arrow because a bunch of wolves are coming at her. Then you have to aim and shoot the wolves. I think that's more of a reactionary thing. They did that a lot better. That was engaging. It was a bit scary. It was tense, and you had to think on your feet. It was way more towards, you know, reactionary, like the kind of reactionary stuff you want, not press button. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. I had this other bit where, and I specifically saw reviewers kind of call this out and complain about it, and I got irrationally cross about it, where she's climbing a radio tower to send a distress call, and it's after you've made your way through this base, and it's kind of the first time in the game you've had a really big, prolonged firefight,
right.
And it's really tense. I found it quite difficult anyway, and the only way I could kind of get through it was by being a real scumbag and just being really horrible to the bad guys and like tricking them around doors and shooting them when they're looking the wrong way. And I felt really bad after it. And it was very kind of tense and exhausting. And then you have this long sequence where she climbs up the ladder to this radio mast.
Mm-hmm.
And all you have to do is hold down up on the control pad and she climbs. And every now and again, that one of the rungs will break and she'll wobble. And then she'll catch on and she'll keep going. And I saw like a couple of reviewers say, "That's why am I even having to press up? That's ridiculous. It's just the illusion of threat. Why am I having to do that?" And it drove me insane because the reason you're having to do it is because it keeps you active, even in a very minor sense. It keeps you engaged with the game because, yes, you don't have to then kind of press left and right when a rung breaks, but you don't know that while you're climbing. They've done all sorts of, sprung all sorts of stuff on you just before then. And it stops you from relaxing until you reach the top of the radio tower, and then it gives you a proper cutscene, and it's kind of, it's the best moment in the game. It's this total tonal shift. It's really, it's a really powerful moment, beautiful. But it would not be that powerful if you hadn't still been on edge, up until right in front of it.
Right. And
that's where something like QTEs can work, I think. And what did these reviewers want? Did they want you to have to press, you know, A and B every now and again while you're climbing the ladder? They've just been complaining about QTEs in the previous paragraph. I presume not. It's not about presenting a threat or a challenge at that point. It's just about about managing kind of the player's tension level.
Well, they're probably saying they wanted to fade in, fade out. Like, you're atop a tower, yay. That's probably what they wanted.
Yeah, I guess that would weaken that moment of...
Yeah, I think what you did was right. I think this is how I see it. Like, it's that moment, when you reach the top, it's like the climax, right? It's like the top of the hill. And fighting everything is going, you know, climbing up the hill. And that whole ladder sequence is like, when you're almost there, you're like so close. Like, it really captures that moment of you're so close. And it's so dangerous, but you got to get pushed right through it. And it's all more rewarding when you get to that top, right? And I think that is that plateau of her character, too. You know, that's when she starts to really believe in herself. She starts being a scared girl and starts being a survivor, right?
That's the first time she's really achieved something in the game that hasn't gone disastrously wrong or been compromised somehow.
Also,
and it is later compromised because the player comes to rescue her. But at that moment, she thinks she's done brilliantly. She thinks that her problems are all over. And then at the end of it, she has to kind of go back down. Going back down into this island is all going to get awkward. Mm-hmm.
Right. Just climbing back down would be scary, actually. Climbing up something would be scary to me. I'm just like, I'll talk about heights. I was really high up.
Yeah, I thought as we talked about with saying the island as an environment, Tomb Raider just really good job of making it just come alive, like as we get further into it, like when you reach like the shanty town, for instance. Like, it just does a really good job of showing this world as being lived in. And when I talked about storytelling a few months ago, I brought Lord of the Rings as being a really good example of it felt like this world has age to it. And Tomb Raider did that as well. Like, it never felt like you were going to this sterile place where, you know, guys just having to drop in. It always felt like you were moving around to these places that has been lived in. I think what...
It has meaning for the people that live on the island. Yeah.
I mean, it did sort of feel a little gamey as you got further and you started getting more of the upgrades, but it still felt like this was a place that people lived in that you were experiencing in a different light.
And the shantytown is a nice intersection with the game mechanics as well, because in Tomb Raider, that shantytown, because they hit you with an unbelievable combat in that shantytown, but to Lara, that shantytown is like this massive playground, and you can get to anything honest. And the combat, at least if you play it on hard, it's probably too difficult to kind of just sit down where they hit you and kind of snipe them. It's just too intense and brutal for that. I had to move into the town, and then it turned into this unbelievable running battle kind of across the rooftops and through the shantytown and stuff. And there's no way you can't get to or it won't become part of the battle.
And don't forget those explosive barrels everywhere. God.
Yes.
They kept hitting them and making me explode. I'm like, stop it. Stop it. I'm supposed to hit them, not you.
It was for me.
Going back to David Cage for a second with how narrative should be like the first thing and then the gameplay should sort of be like the in-between, between cutscenes or between QTEs. This reminds me a lot of the original games that had this QTE focus, which was the old Dragon's Lair series. Dragon's Lair, Space Ace. And that was in, I think I wrote, 1982, 1983, something like that. And back then, what made these games so popular wasn't really the storytelling, it was the graphics, or specifically the animation. And this is where I have the problem with David Cage's theory that it should be, that story should be played more and gameplay should be relegated to simple interactions, is that a lot of people play Dragon's Lair just simply for the animations. There was just nothing really to hold your interest. And as I think you said earlier, Chris, with how, or maybe it was Ken, regarding the actions being this arbitrary decision, like when you're pressing, you know, square or left, it has no relation to what's going on screen. You're just basically going through the motions, and it's just there really to keep you from putting the control down and, you know, falling asleep. With Metal Gear Solid, I think it was 4, I remember they had like 30 minute to hour long cutscenes. And I think I almost fell asleep a few times because you basically put the controller down, you're doing nothing for 30 to 40 minutes at a time.
Metal Gear Solid 2 had 35 minutes. Yeah, I think maybe you had to like move from one room to another sometime halfway through. Yeah. Ken mentioned Shenmue as kind of the progenitor of the QTEs. Right. And it was. It also was one of the most kind of socially responsible with them, I think, because the buttons you had to press corresponded to the parts of your body that they corresponded to when you were fighting. And Shenmue was really clever about its fighting system and the UI of it and how it related to what you were doing, to the extent that characters in the game could describe to you how to do a fighting move in the fiction verbally, and you could translate that into what buttons you would have to press. So if they said step back and then shift your weight forwards and kick, you knew that would mean back and then forwards and kick at the same time. Mm-hmm. And in the QTEs, though, all those rules still held true. So when you press blue, you were going to do a kick and all the rest of it. And usually when you lost a QTE, you didn't lose the game. You had some other penalty, like you might lose a day of time or something as you kind of were beaten up by a strange person and then had to recuperate or something. Not always. There were some, in Shenmue 2 particularly, there's a bit where you were running through an apartment building, and like three times you had to kick the beam away and drop the ceiling on the people chasing you, which was very weird. And if you lost any of those, it was game over, I think. But most of the time, it was quite sociable.
I never played the second one, actually, because I own it, but I have the Japanese version of it. I'm like, oh, okay.
All right.
I don't know, the European version. It never came out in North America for the Dreamcast.
Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, it did in the EU.
Yeah, I had to.
But you have to get the Xbox one. It's the only one.
Yeah, I actually had to.
It's really good. It's really
definitely
good.
I'd still say that if they released Shenmue 2 as the first game over here, it would have done a lot better, because it really did improve so much on it. And I was one of the people who did actually import it for the European version. Or
darn it, my sister imported the Japanese one for Christmas. I mean, I really did like Shenmue. By the way, talk about Gone Home. They both had the same kind of system where you could just pick up everything. Everything was interactable. Everything. It didn't have a point, but you could grab it.
You said one of the things that attracted you to Gone Home was the interactive fridge. And my most magical moment I had in Shenmue, and I had many and I love Shenmue, was standing at the bus stop waiting for my bus. And it sounds stupid. And if you wrote that in a game design document today, people would burn you alive. It made the world feel so real. And you never had to wait more than like a few minutes. And while you were waiting, I like put on my, it was like a Walkman, wasn't it? Of course, because it was set in the 80s. So you'd put on your Walkman, and you could choose what tape you put in and stuff and listen to music while you were waiting. It was just this weirdly authentic moment. And all those little moments in Shenmue, all those kind of bits where it made recourse to how the real world works, played into its story and keeping the story grounded, despite it being this kind of martial arts revenge epic. It was very low key and very grounded. Like the bit, and my favorite puzzle of all time where you have to find this particular person, and the way you find them is by looking them up in the phone book. And you find the phone book by looking under the phone. That is brilliant.
Yes.
Because I was thinking, I'm going to have to go through all these. I'm going to have to find someone to like steal a phone book. No.
Oh man. So you guess you're still reeling from all the adventure.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Adventure game logic there.
You guys beat me.
Okay, I think go ahead. I was gonna say one of my favorite mundane moments in a game is in Skyrim. I was so impressed by this. So stupid. But I was so impressed by it. I went to an inn. And then someone told me like, "Hey, how you doing? You wanna get some food? Why don't you sit down? We'll serve you some food." I'm like, "Didn't program that." I sit down. A couple of moments later, someone actually comes up to me and opens up a menu with food. I'm like, "Oh my gosh,
that's amazing!
That's amazing!"
Game of the year. Yes.
I'm like, "Yes, that's I can't believe that happened."
You guys beat me to Shenmue and comparing Shenmue to Gone Home. I remember when I played the first one, I just went around his house and just opened up every cupboard, every refrigerator.
Everything.
And I just loved when I found the Sega Saturn in the closet. I thought, ooh, can I play this? And I spent so much time in the supermarket spending my money to get the drawing to win the free copies of, I think it was Space Harrier and one other game.
Yeah, Space Harrier as well. And Road Rash? Is that it? It was bicycle spiking. Super
I don't think it was Road Rash. That was an EA or 3DO game at the time. But so I spent all this time, and I knew that I could just play Space Harrier in their own little arcade, but no, that wasn't the principle. Yeah. I wanted to win the copy so I could just play from his home. I was so proud when I got it finally.
I think I wasted all my money. One time I couldn't proceed in the game, I used all my money on those little castle toys. Yes. Like,
yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Now I can't buy it. Now I can't buy any tickets or anything. No,
but then you
could work.
Take those into Shenmue 2 and sell them to collectors if you had complete sets of different.
Darn
games.
It! I don't have the Japanese version. I can't play it. I can't do it.
And talking about like making the mundane come alive, there is also the part in Shenmue when you had the day job as the forklift driver for two weeks of in-game time or 1 week.
Yeah.
I know some people hated that, but I loved it. I was like, you know what? Yeah. I'm going to make sure to get as much freaking cargo as I can. I don't care. That's my job.
You took pride in that job. Yeah. Everyone, I had people watching me play Shenmue as I was playing it, and that bit, everyone just thought was insane and deranged. But I loved it.
It was fun.
Yeah.
That
probably less fun to watch, admittedly.
Even the racing was fun, all right? I think the thing that was a little hokey to me was that guy that was Jamaican/Japanese, and he would teach you dance moves / karate moves. I think that guy was a little weird. Other than that, I thought the game was pretty grounded.
Hang On was the other game you could play.
Yeah. Oh, Hang On. Okay, it was something like that. I know Space Harrier was definitely one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that attention to detail was insane for that game. I can't believe they put that much detail in a game like that. I think it cost 100. Go ahead.
It's ridiculous. And have you seen the on the net? You can see all the kind of comparison photographs of the places in Shenmue compared to the real world places. Oh, it's incredible! It is incredible. So close.
You should have seen I think there was a Shenmue version on the Sega Saturn. By the way, there was
there was a beta
version of it. Yeah. It looked awful. It looked terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, Shenmue isn't the greatest thing either because people's I don't think their bodies move or something doesn't move. Like it doesn't look realistic in terms of how they're talking to you. I think only their
talking.
Yeah. Their mouths move.
Yeah.
But still, it's freaking ambitious. Every person can talk to, and everyone has a voice actor. Every single one of them.
Yeah. And how the weather matches exactly the weather for that specific day of that year in that location and stuff. The amount of kind of fidelity has it just amazing. In Shenmue 2, the equivalent of forklift driving is, I think there's a director of him, but there's another one where after you finish your day job, you can go and play a blackjack. To try and increase your winnings.
Pachinko.
And I have never been so tense.
Pachinko.
I think there was pachinko machines in Shenmue 2, or I may be thinking of Yakuza.
Yakuza definitely had it, but I don't know if Shenmue had it. I don't play two.
Well, yeah,
because it was money that you had to earn by doing your day job, and then you'd go and gamble it all that night. God, it was so funny.
And it was definitely a game that used the night and day cycle for different events too, which is pretty cool. I just realized the more and more we talk about Shenmue, the more and more I realized Shenmue 3 could never be made. It would cost way too much money. It'd be astronomical costs. It would be like $300 million for a game with such mundane things in it.
Yeah. Well,
talking about storytelling, actually, the final act of Shenmue, uniquely, is one enormous conversation. Yeah. There's no fights, there's no action sequences. It's you and this character who is going to be very significant in the rest of the series, walking through the woods. and you choosing different options to have this conversation.
Yeah, Shenmue 2, I think, right, had like the big forest. Yeah. And then it ended with like sort of revealing part of the mystery and then of course saying to be continued. Yeah. And just stabbing me in the soul right there.
Well, I'm glad they didn't make a Shenmue 3 online if they wanted to do originally. Like, no, PCSK modems, Shenmue 3 online. Sounds like a terrible idea. But it's just one of those games that everyone wishes could be made, but could never, ever make a budget. Even with Kickstarter, they would not even be close to making that. But then again, technology has gotten better. Unity does exist, you know, licensing is not as expensive.
But they wouldn't be satisfied with that stuff, the off-the-shelf stuff, would they? They'd want to handcraft every single thing. Photographs from that period.
And every cabinet must have a completely unique objects in it.
Well, it probably is really smart for them to put it in the 80s because the game will age well in terms of like it's a set piece, you know, a period piece. Yeah. It's really cool. That's a really cool idea because like now kids like, hey kids, you want to see what the 80s were like? Check this out. Like, look at those jeans.
I remember
jeans.
In
tape cassettes
in Shenmue. I remember there was a hidden shop you could find in a back alley like during night that you go in there have all these like curios and you would find like the martial arts scrolls in there. And it was, as you said, it's just so insane the detail they put into that.
You know what would be really great? Someone have some sort of commentary on that game. That would be amazing. Think of how many stories and history would be. I would pay top dollar to see something on that.
That would be a Shenmue documentary on Kickstarter.
God, that would be great.
That's like 2 hour funded right there.
Yeah.
a lot of people like don't know what the hubbub about Shenmue is. It's gotta play it, but keep your expectations low because graphics, but come on, still.
Yeah,
there's nothing else like it.
Nothing like the details they put in
that game. As we talk about, so much of the mundane stuff really came alive, and this is something that I talk about with open world games. I really want to see an open world game done like sort of this day in the life type situation, where you're just going around doing mundane stuff, or you're basically exploring this world, and it's not about, you know, you're jumping over skyscrapers, or you're flying around, but you're just exploring this place and just getting this feel for this environment. And Shenmue, I think, really did that well. Another game, just as a quick aside, I want to talk about in terms of lore and just how much that adds to a world, was the PS2 game Rule of Rose. And I talked about this game many times in the past. I think when I asked both of you, I don't think either of you played it.
Soundtrack, that's all I got. And some of the story.
Well, what I found after playing the game was, I of course mentioned this too, someone on this website basically took every piece of lore and went through in detail explaining how this would relate in real world. And it was just incredible the amount of lore for this very basic horror game. But as we've talked about, when you build the world up as more than just a setting, but almost as its own character, it does so much to elevate the plot. And it also sort of it downplays the alpha hero or, you know, the blockbuster type setting, because then you could see this setting in another game with another character. It's not like with God of War that you can't see God of War, you know, without Kratos, or Uncharted without Nathan Drake.
Rule of Rose was really unique, though, because it wasn't a basic horror game to me, because the antagonists were little girls, right? Mm-hmm. It's really weird. And, like, talk about, like, fairly Western, Victorian style, or not Victorian, but, like, kind of, like, early 1920s kind of girls.
I've just looked this up, and you're not kidding about unique, are you? The initial quote on the website is, 1930s England, the year that marked the start of the Age of the Great Zeppelins. A mysterious story is spreading among the children in one town. The park is dangerous after dark. You will be eaten by stray dogs. People who are eaten are confined to a zeppelin in the sky and can never leave.
Yes.
That is crazy.
Oh my.
Yeah, by the way, I was close for the time. That's in 1920s.
If you haven't watched it yet, Chris, you have to see the intro cutscene with the opening song. I love that song in that game.
That's a great song. Yeah, the Rule of Rose song is great. It's definitely a Japanese singer trying to do an English accent, but hey, they give it the best shot. But yeah, it's pretty messed up because it's like they go over not only like torture and bullying, but also sexualize the characters a little bit too, which is kind of messed up because they're little girls.
There's also,
you know what I mean? So there's a
lot
of
rape and abortion, I think, is one of the parts too.
There's also like worship and stuff. It's really a messed up game. I love it. There's another game like called Haunting Ground that's similar-ish.
No, it has like the main character, I think she's like a 13, 14-year-old girl, and the first guy or the first antagonist is this like giant, like simple-minded brute who he like sees her as like as a doll or something that he can, you know, play with. But yeah, Rule of Rose, the gameplay is just bad. It's horrible.
Bad. But the concept, the art style and concept is great.
It has one of the best endings I've seen in a game, in that, it going back to this idea of wandering around, when you beat the game, the final act is you exploring the whole mansion in, like, modern day, and she's basically talking about her experiences and how, like, each object relates to something that she experienced as a child, and she's just sort of explaining how this whole crazy world took place for her. And, like, with Shenmue, there's no combat in this part. The whole big final battle was one chapter before. So it's this epilogue that I think does such a great way of expanding the world, and it's one of those games that I just hate to love, because on one hand, the gameplay is just abysmal, but on the other hand, the story, the music, and even the voice acting was just top-notch.
Voice acting?
How about music? Let's go with just the music, then.
Yes, the sounds are great.
Although
But the voice acting was one of those, let's just get whoever we can.
Although I will say the battle music, though, that drove nuts. Because the one chapter is just a 40-minute comment section, so they just repeat the battle song for 45 minutes. And
that was like NES games.
Yeah, I was like, I think my ears were starting to bleed by the end of it.
But I think you bring up a good point, though. I think a lot more games are taking more risks in making a non-combat ending. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like a game that actually utilizes all the skills you've garnered that isn't related around melee or combat. Now, it doesn't have to be a giant boss battle. Maybe the big conflict is a conversation. You know, like or it's something that's based on stealth. Like example, like Deus Ex had a horrible ending. How they decided to do it in terms of how you take out all the bosses, right? But in Missing Link, they fixed that problem. Because, again, in the main game, you take out all the bosses through lethal only. Which is weird, because most people play the game stealth, right? Mm. So, again, like what you talked about earlier about being dropped in the middle of, like, 20 alerted people, that's the same thing that happened to Jensen in Deus Ex. A guy with a giant machine gun for an arm, and you have nothing but, like, you have nothing but a taser. You're like, oh, okay, well, I guess I can't do anything, and I'm dead.
I will say the conversation battles in Deus Ex Human Revolution were amazing. That was like, as you talked about with Remember Me, with like the memory parts were like the highlight. The conversation battles were the best parts in Deus Ex for me.
I would go with the stealth too. Stealth, like you can do anything. That was still, I mean, all of it was really good except for the boss battles and the Entron 3000. Other than that, it was good. But you know what another game that did a really, like, I think the best, my memory, of actually conversation games is Alpha Protocol.
Have you played it?
Oh, no, you don't know you played it. Chris, you played it?
Alpha Protocol? I haven't yet. No, it's on my list. It's like I'm super really cheap. Interested.
I've just... like $2.
Yeah.
I mean, Obsidian, you would love it.
Yeah. Again, when it came out, I had a crappy PC, so it wouldn't run, but I could, mine could handle it now. I need to use it again. Yeah.
Well,
I've heard that the kind of, a chunk of the Obsidian games were buggy.
buggy as all hell.
Yeah, well, they're buggy, and the kind of shooting and stealth aren't as good as the conversation.
Well, the thing is that when I say buggy as all hell, I mean, like, there's a point where you can pretty much be invisible and snap everyone's neck and just defeat the whole mission with that. Just run around, snap people's necks, that's it. You can just be, like, right
in
front of them.
And you get the auto-stealth power, that if someone sees you, you immediately become stealth, but they never explain how you do that. Like, do you have, like, a portable stealth there, or do you cast a spell? All of a sudden, you're just staying there, and then you become see-through.
It's called spider sense. They used it. They didn't trademark it. It's called spider sense. But the conversation stuff was, like, the choices you made were all very dire. You know, they all did big, major changes based mission to mission. All of it mattered. All of it really did matter.
It was also, I think this was the first game that predated Walking Dead with having a time decision for your choices. So you had to make these split-second choices.
Oh, yeah.
No. Indigo Prophecy did it before, though. To me, the most engaging thing and the most stressful thing in Indigo Prophecy was the conversations. Because it was the first time I'm like, oh my god, I have 5 seconds to ask questions. What do I say? And there's like three of them. But just, because I actually didn't mention my experience with Indigo Prophecy / Fahrenheit for you guys in the UK, that you, by playing, because you played the main character with the killer, sort of ish, or this is the main killer, and the detectives, and then everything you did and said reflected onto the detectives. Like, example, you didn't mop up the bathroom where the guy was murdered, they would say that you're a messy killer, you know?
Yeah.
We'll comment that later. I thought that was really cool. And
it's
again,
this really interesting sense that you were making things harder for yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I really love that. But
yeah.
then you go into like Heavy Rain and then Two Souls, like Beyond Two Souls or Beyond,
Beyond
is it?
Two Souls.
Beyond
yeah.
Two Souls. Yeah, yeah. Like that's when they start taking it away and it becomes just like you're watching a movie. It's, you're pretty much watching Final Fantasy, Spirits Within kind of thing.
Now without
but you don't
with Alpha Protocol, one thing that I really did like, as you said, with how choices matter, was the fact that what happened was they broke down each chapter into like two or three environments. So I think there was, I think you went to like China or Taiwan one, Russia. And so what they did was you could choose between which one you would go to, and then that would influence what happened in number two and number three. So I remember one time, because I screwed up or I did something wrong in the first area, there was this massive shooting that happened that killed a lot of people. So then when I went to the second environment, as I was stealthing around, I heard people saying, oh, did you hear about that shooting? That was horrible. And I thought that was just a great way of personalizing the story.
Yeah. I just think like that was an amazing tale that we read. It just sucks that they got panned so hard by critics because
yeah.
of all the bugs.
Yeah, the PC version, they never fixed the fact that the hacking games were supposed to be played with two analog sticks. But when you use the keyboard, it's just such a horrible way of playing it.
I mean, how many games have been ruined by consoleization?
Yeah.
I think Dreamfall was definitely one of the major, like, one that I can remember. I'm like, ah, oh, jeez. Putting a combat section in an adventure game makes no sense to me. I felt it was just so out of place. But yeah, I mean, that what you said right there about the dual analogs, what a pain that was.
It's a shame as well because it we don't get a lot of spy games, not a lot of story-driven spy games, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And because Alpha Protocol was panned so hard and didn't do so well, we're not likely to get many more.
Oh, which they would, though.
It's always
interesting good.
When you see someone experiment with a genre that we don't get a lot of, and then it dies. You just know we're not going to see any more of that for years.
Yeah, I mean, of that caliber, we won't see it for a long time. And it was really James Bondy like, because you would go to different like areas and had different caches and secrets to it, and different factions and stuff. Again, thinking about it now, that game was definitely gold. It just was.
Yeah,
it had the trademark of bugs.
Sounds like one of those things where once you've played it, the more time passes, it's the good stuff that you remember, not the bad stuff. Yeah, and there's lots of games that work the other way around.
Speaking about story and gameplay being combined, I liked how when you made choices in the story, they turn into like perks that became attached to your character. So if you were aggressive or you did something in one cutscene, they would say, oh, you're now impulsive, or that gives you +2 to pistols or something like that. But it's such a great way of tying in your choices to the actual gameplay.
Yeah, we got intrinsic rewards, right?
Yeah.
In a way.
And it's unusual for mechanical rewards to be given based on fictional events in games. Normally it's like a gameplay event, it's an achievement, or it's like you've reached a certain point in the game, now you deserve this. It's unusual for it to have that direct correlation with the fiction. Did you ever play another game that did a similar thing, Rise of the Argonauts?
I know that game, but
no.
It's interesting. I played a load of it on PC and then had to stop because the PC conversion is terrible. Absolutely terrible. I want to grab it on the Xbox and play it because the story is, it starts out quite sort of cutscene heavy, but then it gets really interesting, and really clever, because for a start, you play Jason of the Argonauts, so you're a king. So within half an hour of starting the game, you're sitting on your throne, passing judgment on people that are being brought before you. And because it's based on kind of Greek myth, although it's very much its own kind of take on it, and because you're a king, you have relationships with all the other people in the game. So when you set off on your ship, you get to decide what island you go to. And each of the islands, the people there, you already have some sort of relationship with. So the first one I went to was the island that was dedicated to Ares, god of war. And the king of it was the father of the woman Jason had married and failed to protect, who had died in the opening cutscene. So you're going to this place and you land there and you know you're going to have to apologize to this guy for letting his daughter die. You know, it's already a charged situation you're going into. But one of the really clever things they did was their whole experience system was based on their conversation system, where when you each choice on the conversation wheel was associated with a particular Greek god. So the sort of wise choice was associated with Athena, the brash choice with Ares, the like cunning one was Mercury, and I think like the lordly one was Zeus or something. I can't remember. And the more you chose the options that corresponded with a particular god, the more that god's skill tree opened up, and the more skills you could learn from that god. So like, the spear was associated with Athena, so the more Athena choices you made, the more spear skills you could learn. And it was really interesting. It was a really clever way to take a really kind of abstract game system and overlay fiction onto it so that it made sense within the context. Because, you know, in Skyrim, it doesn't really make any sense that you look up at the sky and then you learn how to jump better or anything. At least there's this nice little element of looking up at the sky, but it's not really a fictional justification. But this did it. It tied it in with the gods and who kind of favor you had won and stuff.
Right. And
then sorry, go.
I was about to say, like, it also adds on to teaching people about mythology. Mythology that not everyone knows, too.
Yeah, that's right. So as you were playing, you were sort of learning more about these gods, which were an active part of the game, and you could occasionally sort of meet emissaries of and interact with and stuff. Yeah, it was really clever. And because those were the divisions, like empathy, brashness, cunning, or humour, and no, it was Apollo, the other one, kindness, I think, got away from the whole good option, evil option that became very prevalent following like Knights of the Old Republic, I think. Lots of RPGs got really focused on this whole go towards the black side or the white side of a bar kind of thing. And this didn't. There's some cases where the brash option was the right option to take, or if not the right option, at least the most satisfying option. You know, sometimes you came across someone that you really, really wanted to punch in the face, and it was just the most satisfying thing to do, and therefore you'd end up kind of in area's favor and stuff. It's really, really, really terrible.
Now you make me want to try this.
It's good. Give it a shot. Do not try the PC version.
Maybe someone patched it. There's always a fan base.
It no. Oh well, maybe actually it hadn't been that.
Look at what was it? Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, right?
Yeah.
That game was buggy, really great game, crazy bugs, but I mean, yeah, people patch it to this day, and it's really, really good. It's a really, really funny game.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I just remember that I just wish that the story and the choices in the early part of Vampire would carry on to the end, because it became just so combat-focused, similar to what we said with Deus Ex, that if you went the conversation or the passive route, you would just get screwed when you ran into like a boss who you just had like a little pistol to have to fight.
Well, let me just say that game was hats and balls. They tried some a lot of amazing stuff with that new engine that no one knew. They were the first source engine games, but they had a lot of great set pieces too, like the haunted house, which is really cool because you live in a world where magic is possible because you're a vampire. Come on, you know. There's the Malkavian clan, the people that, like, if you pick this class, they're vampires that are already crazy. They're crazy. So when they talk to you, like, you know, you would say, like, maybe you would choose an option with a normal character, and they would be like, can you please pass that drink? And then if you played Malkavian, you'd be like, Sir Snake, pass this, the Hydra of the Vivivin Olynthus. And you'd be like, and everyone would be like, what did you say? But it had a whole branch. Every single choice you could ask them to make was translated into crazy talk. It was
and
the greatest thing.
Change the game so you saw stuff in a crazy way.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
if you were Malkavian, at one point the TV started talking to you. Is that right?
Yeah, stuff like that would happen all the time. Or you could just confuse people too with your crazy talk, and they would just go on your side. So yeah, it was a lot of crazy stuff like that. Actually, one of my funniest game jokes is from Bloodlines, by the way. There was you could buy a fire axe. And the description was like a weapon for the true madman. An axe that's on, something about an axe on fire. I have to remember it though. But it's such a clever game with so much put into it. Same thing, kind of like, not saying like Shenmue level, but I'm saying like it had a lot of a detail that was placed into that game, but had just development hell and publisher hell all over that thing. And I don't know if that brand can ever come back. I really want another Vampire Masquerade game though. So I loved Redemption. I loved Bloodlines, but yeah.
Is Redemption the kind of arcade RPG, action RPG?
No, this one's like, it's more of a linear gameplay. You control like a squad. You play as like a crusader who gets like taken.
Yeah.
It's a game that goes throughout the years. Like you like Dragon Age 2 going throughout the years. It's the same thing. He goes from, you know, the Crusades all the way to present day 1990s.
This is the one I was thinking. Yeah, this is,
It's funny because if you look at the models, I played it the other day because I got on GOG, but if you look at the models, one hand's always in a fist, so a sword can go into it, and the one's always open, so it's really funny. I'm like, good job, guys, cutting down polygons. But yeah, Ivan, this is good. Another one of those one of those cool games. But again, it's a pretty hard game to write a story for, I would say, because they have so many different choices. So whenever everyone makes like an ambitious game like that, I respect them a lot for it.
Mm.
So yeah. Oh yeah, and before I got off Bloodlines, there is another funny moment where there's a mind control spell you can get, or like a persuasion spell you can do. But if you refuse one of the main characters, he uses it against you, and all your dialogue choices become the same word. Like, that's brilliant.
Genius.
I know.
Nice.
I will go to Mary Celeste.
All right, moving on. One topic that I also want to touch on as we move from AAA to the independent market is the idea of narrative-heavy games. And it seems lately, whenever a journalist writes about what storytelling should be or the best examples of what they feel of games based on more of a narrative focus are stuff like, as we said, Gone Home, Dear Esther, and games that generally have a greater focus on storytelling and less about gameplay. So my question to both of you is, do you think that is the way game storytelling should go, or you think that is a viable option, to have a focus of narrative over gameplay?
I don't think narrative should overtake gameplay. That should be something that's mm-hmm. in tandem with each other, right? You don't want to have to sit through, you don't want a game where you sit through cutscenes and press a button and then go to the next cutscene. This isn't Final Fantasy 14 1.0, okay? It's not, but, yeah, I mean, I don't think that, if that was the case, then you should just watch a movie. You're taking away one of the greatest elements that games offer, which is interactivity, right? And engagement. If you take those away, then what's the point, right? So, again, they have to work in tandem, which is why, like, BioShock does such a great job, because, again, I mean, the reason why all these things are attacking you is because, you know, they all went crazy, and the story also reinforces that concept and makes you feel more engaged and immersed in the world. And I think, again, it's not just interactivity, but immersion too, which is another big one too. Because the more you're just watching a screen, the less immersed you are, right? Which is why we're going so farther into virtual reality. Yeah.
I think that's completely true. I think that also, though, not every game needs to be very complex mechanics or very challenging mechanics. There's plenty of space for games that have quite simple gameplay, as long as that gameplay fits the story. And there's no shortage of people who would be happy to play an interactive story, but would never play a kind of more serious video game, or a game that's, even if it's not serious, like a game like Mario or something that is very gamey. I think the word game covers this huge spectrum of activities, and I think there's room on that spectrum for games that are very light on gameplay, as long as the style of gameplay doesn't undermine the narrative. And that's where the problem comes in, where the gameplay undermines the narrative all the other way around, when one of them is acting contrary to the other.
I think what we should do is start getting away from set pieces and cutscenes. I think that's very important to
yes.
do.
Yeah.
And I think, like, an example, you know what I really loved? If you ever played any of the games from, they made Max Payne series.
Remedy,
yes. Remedy's one of my favorite studios. It's just sad that they couldn't continue on with Alan Wake. But, Max Payne 2 is my favorite games of all time, because I love noir of any kind, and that's definitely one of the best of it. But they told a lot of their stories through, instead of watching a cutscene, and there were cutscenes in the game, but there was television screens, which would show, like, random little shows, and they would complement what the character was thinking and going through, like Lords and Ladies, and Captain Baseball Bad Boy, and Dick Justice. That, you know, there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek in it, which was so beautiful and very funny, but also helped flesh out the character's world a little bit. And I think Max Payne 3 really missed that out. It made him just a pure nihilist, not what Max Payne was. Mm. But again, that's another interesting way of telling a story, is using... And then Alan Wake, if you played that, also used television screens too, by using, Bright Balls or whatever? The Twilight Zone parody show?
Oh, yeah.
They did that in Alan Wake also. But again, you don't have to watch your screen. You can just walk by them. But if you sit there and watch it, then it's your choice, right? Then you can be engaged in that kind of way. And it feels more cemented to the world, too.
And going back to, I'm trying to think what we were talking about earlier with having that choice between, Dark Souls. It sort of is like Dark Souls, and how the story is there, but it's optional, that you choose to explore the story. It's not like you have to stop and read, you know, five paragraphs of text. If you want to know more about, you know, a doll, or more about this key, you can read it, and that's your choice.
And I really think that's, I see bad storytelling or bad writing, it's usually when the game or movie is full of just exposition. The whole thing is exposition. It's bad to me, you know? Like, Avatar, that horrible Shyamalan's version of Avatar. Yeah. All of it was exposition. None of it was engagement. Everything had to be told to you. It was horrible. And it actually, one of my favorite moments of bad exposition is in the next, you know the movie, The Next Karate Kid?
I don't think I've ever watched the whole thing.
It was the one with the female,
yeah.
The Karate
yeah,
Kid.
Yeah, like the third one, yeah.
Okay, so when she first gets introduced to Mr. Miyagi, she's like, why don't, she's like being like really bratty. And then she leaves, and then the mother's like, stop. Do what I say. It's like, I don't have to do what you said. My parents both died in a car accident, so I'm all alone, so I don't want to talk to you. Goodbye. I'm like, wow. Oh, wow, that's real subtle, you know? So, like, that's, like, the worst, one of the worst examples of exposition I've ever heard, or, like, explanation of a background. And I think that games that do that and other stuff like that don't respect the intelligence of their audience. And I think it's always better when it's subtle. And I think games like Gone Home, a lot of it, and what your interpretation of the story is subtle. And that's why I love it.
And
that example is a real shame. The Karate Kid One, I would hold up as a masterpiece in dramatic storytelling and show don't tell and dramatic situations. I watched it again recently and just thought, gee, I will never write anything this good. It's genuinely brilliant. And then it's in this weird kind of cheesy 80s summer popcorn movie, but it is dramatic. The performances are brilliant. The dialogue is brilliant. The stories are brilliant. It's weird, weirdly good.
I think I think the weakest thing about that movie is though, even though I love the villains, they're the weakest part.
Yeah.
They're so
you're
over the top.
You're absolutely right.
Cooper,
yeah.
Never done.
Yeah, it's just so fun. But even then, there's this little moment at the end where like one of them apologizes to Daniel and stuff. But no, you're right. Most of the time, they're totally I had a game experience recently where the narrative and the gameplay were totally at odds. I just had to go and look up what the game was in my Steam library. But it's an RPG called Inquisitor.
That looked cool.
And this, I think, I think it's French originally. It's a RPG. I was interested because, I don't think it's actually set in 14th century Europe, but it's set in like an analog of 14th century Europe. Yes, that's right. But the idea is you're a member of the Inquisition, and it had all this stuff in the blurb about, you know, difficult choices and do the ends justify the means and stuff. And I thought, well, I don't know if I've come across a game that's really done that well yet, but I would like to see a game try. I think that would be really interesting. So I got this game hoping for, you know, to be a person in a position of power and then being faced with difficult decisions about how to use that power and have to make decisions about what is the truth worth and what is evil and what methods does it justify. So I load it up. I'm confronted immediately with a terrifying page of statistics and that I have to assign points to and no indication of what is high and what is low and what they'll do. So I do that. I start playing and then wham! There's this like crazy cutscene, and bear in mind one of the reasons I got into this was for the moral ambiguity, okay, the uncertainty of is it ever right to use kind of awful methods in pursuit of good ends. So the first cutscene says a comet hit Earth and all the demons escaped from hell and now they're running over Earth and they've eaten half of the cities. So moral ambiguity kind of out of the window, right? Already evil exists and it's probably eaten your nephew. The next thing that happens is I get this still static screen of text, like top to bottom, my screen full of text saying that I'd been wandering around and then I'd been taken by the Inquisition and they'd tortured me and then they were going to kill me. But then someone walked in and said that they had to spare me. And then they said, okay, we'll spare you. But if we do, you've got to do a job for us. You've got to become an Inquisitor and you've got to go and root out magic in this town. And it says that in like a thousand words or something. It's a screen. It's ridiculous. And so it's this ludicrous sequence of events to set up you working for the Inquisition and yet being a level one adventurer with no equipment or justice. I then get to actually play the game after however long. And I'm put on a road outside of this town. There's a guard outside the town. I walk up to the guard and he says, and so I say, I work for the Inquisition. I need to get into the town. I hear you've got a witchcraft problem. And he said, the town is being attacked by giant bats. You must kill the giant bat. And then I have to go and walk around the town to find a giant bat and kill the giant bat. Only I didn't kill the giant bat because I only got a knife. So I found a giant bat and then the giant bat ate me. And then I uninstalled the game.
The end.
Good. Good.
All the kind of ridiculous overused tropes of RPGs slapped onto this. What sounded like an interesting concept. And then they don't get to any of that interesting stuff that their concept set up because they're too busy making me kill bats.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was interesting just because it looked like Diablo 2. I'm like, is it like Diablo 2? I'm going to give it a shot. I never actually played it. It's not. It's probably not. I think I watched a review on it. I'm like, I don't want this.
Now, speaking of Diablo, one of the things that just really annoyed me about Diablo 3, and this is my example of bad storytelling, is how everything was sort of like, it just happened like as just a bunch of twists. Like, well, oh no, she's bad. One, she just turns bad for no reason. The witch in Diablo 3. And then you discover that the Leia was Diablo's, you know, daughters. Sorry for spoiling the game, but if you
you son of a gun
playing Diablo 3 for the story and not the loot, you're doing it wrong. But it was just like twist after twist. Like nothing seemed to happen in what would be considered like a logical for the world sense. It was just like, as we talk about the whole blockbuster, it just had to keep escalating. And the Diablo, while, as I said, the story hasn't really been a huge part of it, the previous games did have a fairly well-established plot. I love all, like, the little lore in the manual behind the various classes, and, like, the story behind how they captured Tal Rasha and stuff like that. Or even in StarCraft, just one last quick one, StarCraft, they had actual lore for all the researches and how that made sense for that species.
I actually like Diablo 1 setup. Sorry, just real quick. I like Diablo 1 setup about the, it could make sense. You're just an adventurer seeing what the hell happened in this church, which has a million levels down to hell.
Diablo 1 is a textbook example of how to make your story suit your gameplay. Because Diablo 2, I don't think, does it nearly as well. And Diablo 2, the whole story of Diablo 2 is about you arriving 5 minutes after everything interesting happened. And if only you hadn't, you know, wasted your time,
tied your shoes,
tried socketing new gems in your magic staff, maybe you'd have been there in time to stop some of these things happening. But Diablo 1, it's all about the place, the story of Tristram. All the bad guys are people of Tristram who you hear about before you go down into the dungeon. And admittedly, a chunk of the story is in the manual rather than in the game, which is a shame. But it's good stuff in the manual, and it's a unique fantasy setting. I can't think of another fantasy setting that had that angel and demon feel to it. And it makes the only direction that matters in Diablo is down. And all your progress in the game is going down, down, down. And it's got this brilliant justification. If you start in a church, the house of heaven, and you go down into the crypts where the graves are, and then you go down again into the caves, and then you go down and break, you go so far down, you break into hell, and you keep going. It's a whole journey through the cosmology of the world done in this one single story. It's really efficient and really powerful.
Said with how you're introduced to these characters through the manual before you meet them, it's such a great storytelling of how these characters become corrupted. I think my favorite enemy was the fallen angels when they get their skin is like stretched and become these like giant brute-like creatures. That was just really good in the whole fall of King Leoric.
King Leoric will always be it for me. He's the one for me, especially since I don't know if you've ever played much Diablo on multiplayer. It was huge amounts of fun, and the key moment as to whether you would be able to continue playing this world or whether you'd have to start again is whether some annoying git opened Leoric's door too early. Because if they did, the level would suddenly be flooded by skeleton warriors and an undead king you couldn't defeat, and you'd just have to restart and take your characters into a new world.
Oh yeah, I think to me the end-all boss, or the end-all horrible, the scary thing in Diablo was the Butcher. The Butcher was always fast, always scary.
Yeah.
And that always terrified me. Eventually, I had to look online how to beat him, and I just like shot arrows through like a grate, and that's how I killed him. But yeah, he was horrifying because he's so strong, so fast, and his weapon was pretty good throughout most of the levels.
Yeah.
And but was Diablo 1 mostly all voice acted, or was it only like
I think it was, wasn't it?
I think it was. I know there was definitely voice acting in it, but was it all voice acted? It was on CD, so
possibly.
Maybe.
Yeah, man.
Either way, I really like the snarky voice acting on all of them. They did a pretty good job. Yeah. And that stupid drunk. And that witch. I loved it. So I did like Diablo's too. But again, what you said, like the combination of narrative and gameplay and like how that all the setting and everything, I think they set up a great lore for the whole thing. And the allegory between, you know, the heaven and hell kind of thing was cool. So yeah.
I love the idea of Diablo 2 that the person you're chasing after is your character from Diablo 1. That's brilliant.
Well, he had a stupid idea. Spoilers right here. Guy shoves a soul stone in his brain or his head. I'm like, what's wrong with you?
His options were limited. I mean,
although they never quite explain how, if you were playing as the Amazon or the rogue from Diablo 1, how you sticking the gem in your hip turned you into a man. But,
retcon. You only play one character.
All right. The last topic that I want to talk about, at least for today's cast, is the concept of episodic games and how that relates to storytelling. Now, when episodic games first came on the scene, I think that was 2006, 2007, the first big example was the Sins game, the Sins Episode 1, and how people were telling this as, you know, the next step in video games, yada, yada, yada. And the problem was Sins just fell flat. It got one episode, they were trying to tell a story, and nothing happened. And then the ball got picked up by Telltale with the Sam & Max games, and then Wallace and Gromit, Monkey Island, and of course The Walking Dead. And this is where I'm somewhat of two minds about with episodic gameplay. Because as we talked about, some of the best video game narratives are when the story and the gameplay sort of combine. But when I play a game like Walking Dead, the gameplay never really evolved. It basically kept to the same, and you could arguably say there was less gameplay as the episodes went on. If you look at the final episode, there was pretty much, I think there was like one puzzle in the entire episode. So with episodic gameplay for both of you, how do you view it in terms of narrative? Do you think it's a good example of storytelling? Do you think it's bad or whatever?
I think it can be either. I'm not sure the format of episodic play dictates how well the narrative works. I think with Walking Dead, the gameplay is in choice and consequence rather than overcoming obstacles and sort of making do with what you've got and navigating through these difficult circumstances. But I think the appeal to episodic play was a business model that you could release kind of, you wouldn't have to invest, you know, millions in making a single game and hope it did brilliantly. You could invest a modest amount and release smaller games regularly. But that was quite a struggle for people to get right. It took Telltale a while, didn't it, to kind of hit their stride in their release schedules, I think. And I guess the most famous episodic games are Half-Life 2, Episodes 1 and 2, which weren't what you'd call regular regular releases.
All right, it'll come soon.
Yeah. Any minute now. I don't know. I think Telltale really focused on it and hammered away at it and spent the time getting it right until they'd got this solid release schedule in these systems where they can really. Walking Dead is a really impressive package. I feel like they've kind of nailed it. And the story of Walking Dead, the gameplay may not evolve, but the story fits that episodic format. Because it comes from originally a comic and then TV. So it's kind of episodic in nature anyway.
I think it's a way better translation than the television series actually, you know, in actuality. I think that not only were the choices and stuff very difficult, I think they did the best use of children I've ever seen in a game before with Clementine. She's definitely, because she's not a detriment. She's just like a real child. She'll do things wrong, but if you tell her, you know, if you explain things to her, she'll learn. And she isn't clueless. She's actually smarter than a lot of the survivors that exist, especially that one high school kid. So a good use of that and a good use of minority. Like, it's just, I mean, they have a good sense. I really think they did a really great job in that whole game. That's both a narrative and a gameplay aspect in terms of decision choices.
For me, I think what I would like to see episodic gameplay evolve to would be not just evolving a story, but evolving gameplay. Like, let's say you start with a character who uses, you know, traditional weapons, swords, guns, whatever. And then as the episodes or the season goes on, those weapons, those gameplay mechanics fade away or they change to something else. And I think that's where we would start to see sort of the gameplay and the narrative intertwine in that sense. But I don't know if we can actually do that with an episodic game. I mean, if you look at Telltale with their engine, each game makes use of the same engine, so they can't really fundamentally change that engine without reworking the entire game. And I've been hearing that sort of problem with their latest game. I think we talked about this before the cast, the Fables one, and how people are saying that they're running into like the same stuttering and some of the same performance issues with The Walking Dead.
Weren't most of those issues with the consoles, though, over PC?
No, I've been seeing some with the PC as well. I know with The Walking Dead, I did have some stuttering with the animations. But then again, it could have also been by the fact, as you just said, that it's being released cross-platform.
I think the other complication is getting gameplay to work is really, really hard. So if you're having to come up with new gameplay for each episode of an episodic game, I think it's going to be very hard to make that gameplay really satisfying and not feel sort of half-baked. But it would be really fascinating to see. I think it would be fascinating to see games that were kind of completely different games that represented the changing of the narrative. So if you like, let's look at my bookshelf. The Conan stories by Robert E. Howard. If you arrange them chronologically, they start out with him being like this penniless thief, and then he ends up being like a mercenary captain, and then he finally ends up a king. And it would be interesting to see a game that was the same story and the same character, and the first game was like a stealth game, the second game was a RTS, and the third game was a kind of kingdom management game. I think something like that could be really interesting, especially how the choices you made in one affected the choices in the other. But then we can't get over the fact that you're making three different games. Making one game is really hard, and making three games is really hard.
I think that would defeat the purpose of the episodic too, because then you're increasing your costs, right?
Absolutely.
But I think
I think
game like Vampire the Masquerade, Redemption could be broken up into episodic because it's different time periods, right? Mm-hmm. Each time period is a different episode. That would make sense. Like I think the whole time thing actually plays pretty well in an episodic game.
I guess you could do something like different characters in the same situation, and each episode is from a different person's perspective and stuff like that. There are other kind of narrative angles to take at it.
Definitely, that could do that. The one too. Either I think there's so many possibilities when you break it up into a piece instead of having to tell the whole thing at once. And like, plus, you can also show so much more because the length of the episodes can vary. You know, like look at Walking Dead. Like the first one was like four hours or so, and the last one was like an hour. Mm. You know, so you could extend it and make it like a pretty lengthy game in total, but you can give it to people in sizable chunks. That's why people like The Walking Dead also.
And I know some people who, when they play The Walking Dead, they either play each episode the second it came out, and then there are other people who they wait for all five chapters, I think, and then they just sat down and one day just went through the whole thing. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we can actually talk about, because we've been...
Well, have you guys played Sin Valley episode 1?
I haven't played it.
Guys missing out. That's
I don't
great.
Think so.
Okay. So once in, I actually really did want them to canoe it. No. Oh well. I'm sure the art style and stuff doesn't hold up. At least the art doesn't hold up. But anyways, go on.
Oh, so it is based on the old 90s Sin. Game Sin. Good grief.
Yeah. Actually, if you bought it, I bought day one. I got the original Sin game. Ah, yeah.
Wow. Lucky you.
Oh no, it's so bad. I can punch people in it.
Now I remember what I was going to say. Going back to where you were just talking about, Chris, with having a game sort of evolve across different gameplay or different genres, when we talk with Keith Nemitz about his game, Seven Grand Steps, that's sort of how that game went, but at a more basic level. How it worked was, as you play the game, you would move up on this board that represented the various classes of life. And if you actually got to the top, that would be considered the ruling class. And when you did that, the entire game changed into like a kingdom management game, because now you're not just the guy living in the city, you're the guy ruling the city. And I thought that was a really interesting way of having the gameplay sort of evolve with the narrative.
They muffed it up.
Yeah, it was sort of like you made all these promises in the first half, and then you had to decide who you would support and who you would keep with when you reached the second half. But I heard that it reached a point where you could just basically throw money at all the problems and it would go away.
Oh yeah, I was about to say I remember you can nullify all the risk and stuff if you have enough money. That's kind of beats it, you know.
Yeah.
It's all about your treasury. If they said it was based on the company treasury and not your personal treasury, then it probably would have made it a lot more serious.
Right. Well, at this point, we are just under 3 hours of cast.
Holy.
And I know we could probably talk a lot more about it, but I think we've got a lot covered today. So I think it's all right with you guys. I think we can start to wrap this up at this point.
You forgot to let him plug his game.
So, I guess the last thing, do you guys have any final words you would like to say about game storytelling?
I think if I hear myself say anything else, I'll have to strangle myself.
Dreamfall chapters. Okay, that's it.
All right, I think with that said, I think this is on record as our longest cast. So, Chris, Ken, it was great having you guys on. And hopefully, Chris, we can get together later in the month as we're planning on doing the horror theme podcast. Possibly in 2 weeks, or maybe just in time for Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so with that said, we're going to end things here. As always, for those of you listening, if you would like to contribute either by writing a piece for the site or being a future podcast member, please email us. You can find the link under Submissions Wanted. That will take you to our guidelines page for the submission pieces, and that will also be where you can find the email to contact us. With that said, hopefully you're still awake after listening for 3 hours. Thank you for tuning into this edition of Perceptive Podcast. By the time you hear this, the weekend will probably be over. So have a great week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.